Hey there, everybody. It is November the 3rd, 2010. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay, and you're listening to This Show Is So Gay on WVEWLP 107.7 FM Brattleboro Community Radio. We're also broadcasting with pride worldwide on QNation.fm, hanging out over on ClickClickExposed.com, Free Thought Radio, Grateful Dread Public Media, all good places. Thank you for joining me. I am Ken, joined this week by
Jody.
Jody's back.
Yay.
You want to do an impression of someone?
Okay.
Do an impression of... I didn't even wait for your answer. on the spot, do an impression of Jody the last time she co-hosted. I'm Ken.
Jody.
Oh, she was sick. I was sick.
And I am not sick anymore.
She's not. Happy day. Are you emotionally sick this day after Election Day?
For some states, but not for our state.
Not for our little enclave.
No, not for our little oasis.
Yes.
Yeah.
Of Vermont. Well, let's put some national perspective on this a little bit. David Cicilline will become the fourth openly gay member of the House of Representatives, joining Tammy Baldwin, Barney Frank, and Jared Polis in the 112th congressional session. The 49-year-old mayor of Providence, Rhode Island, survived a last-minute attack on his sexual orientation in the form of a flyer reading, and I quote, "Alert! Before you vote for U.S. Congress, you should know that John Laughlin is a husband and father and believes in traditional family values. Cicilline is an openly gay man who supports same-sex marriage." But apparently that swayed people to vote for Cicilline because he will become the fourth openly gay member of our Congress. So that's pretty darn cool.
That is good.
It's pretty cool. Yeah. Did you see my Facebook status this morning?
I don't think I did.
One of the aspects of the Senate that I don't think is receiving a lot of coverage is that based on yesterday's election, there will no longer be any black people in the Senate
at
all.
I did see that.
Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
I think that's messed up.
It is messed up.
I think that's messed up. So I'm going to keep going with positive news, although the not having black people in
that's
the Senate,
not positive news. Right.
But back on the fourth gay person, the Gay and Lesbian Victory Fund reported a record-breaking number of wins for LGBT candidates for public office across the United States in 2010. According to a statement released today by the Victory Fund, quote, "At least 106 of the group's record-breaking 164 endorsed candidates were winners as of Wednesday morning. Victories among many notable wins include the election of Jim Gray as mayor of Lexington, Kentucky, as the state's second-largest city, and the election of Nikki Antonio to the Ohio House, making her the first openly LGBT person to serve in the state legislature." So
very
they're
cool.
Very excited over there at the Victory Fund and gay people all over the place.
Nice.
And I will say that Chuck Wolf, the CEO of the Gay and Lesbian Victory Fund, is going to be on a show coming up real soon.
Very cool.
I think it's 2 weeks from tonight he's going to be on. So that's the good news.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it, right? No. So that's the good news. There's just kind of a general feeling of dread on the LGBT sites today, and they mm-hmm. weren't very specific. There was one specific article, and the headline for this one was over on theadvocate.com, and it posed the question, "Republican House takeover bad for those with HIV and AIDS?" And the text, "The Republican takeover of the House of Representatives may have some far-reaching implications for health care for people with HIV and AIDS. Now that the GOP has a strong majority in the House, key proponents of advancement in AIDS treatment no longer hold leadership roles. Additionally, Republican campaigns this fall focused on reducing federal spending on discretionary programs such as the Ryan White Care Act, the HIV Prevention Program at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and substance abuse and mental health services for people living with HIV." So there are a lot of fears that this wave-o-Republican will affect HIV and AIDS funding.
Mm.
So how do you feel? You are gay.
Yes.
Okay. Outing you on the air.
Oh dear.
Yes. How do you feel? Do you have a gut reaction, a knee-jerk reaction
mm-hmm.
to a wave of Republicans coming into office?
It makes me concerned.
Tell me.
It makes me concerned that they are going to have knee-jerk gut reactions to cutting spending on things that are actually really critical mm-hmm. to the healthy functioning of our society. When we were just starting to get to limp along with maybe some new initiatives and particularly healthcare reform, I'm really concerned about some sort of repeal of healthcare reform. I think of all the things that actually makes me the most concerned is that there's going to be this kind of some attempt of backlash of trying to get rid of that. And I think that's a bad idea. Yeah. I think it's a really bad idea. For a bunch of reasons, one, not least of which, lots and lots of money currently is being spent on preparation for this to be implemented. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many conferences I've been to and workshops where the main focus and the speakers and all of the presentations are all about, all right, you got to get ready, y'all. You got to do it. And so all these PowerPoints, all these people are getting paid and their travel time and all these documents are being produced right. and systems are being created. And if all of a sudden they decide, no, sorry, we're going to do something entirely different, then that's actually a big other waste of money.
Right.
Huge waste of time, effort. It is, because there's going to be another lag of whatever implementation of whatever they come up with.
Right.
So I think work with what we have. Don't make us go backward. And really listen to what's going on. And I also say I'm going to be going to a bunch of advocacy workshops,
nice.
Policy advocacy workshops, specifically around advocacy for substance abuse prevention and treatment and
okay.
recovery services. But advocacy is advocacy, and it works for pretty much anything. And I would encourage all people who are concerned about stuff to actually pick up a phone and call their legislator. Because at the first advocacy training that I've been to, one of the things that they said is that people don't do that. They don't call. They're afraid to. They don't know what to say. They don't think they're going to be listened to, whatever. Mm-hmm. And because there aren't so many people calling, there's just lots of email. And email is so easy to ignore. But the phone calls are the rare things. And those actually count for a lot more. So I just encourage people, if you are concerned, if you want to talk to these new legislators about, here's how I feel and I want mm-hmm. you to hear from me, call them. Call them as soon as they have a contact number, phone number to call.
You know why else they're not calling?
Why?
Because, and I mean this, they live in Vermont. I would like to say, I have a whole point here.
Okay.
Jody, as an advocate.
Yes.
As someone who's looking to create change.
Yeah.
Isn't it irresponsible of you to be living in Vermont? And I'll go further with that. I've been thinking about this all day. It's
uh-huh.
like, oh, I would like to, if there was some way to quantitatively measure
uh-huh.
the angst about the election,
mm-hmm.
I think that it would be somehow muffled here in Vermont, the angst, because we sit on our mountaintop of liberalism and yes, it was so terrible, but, and you said this right before the show,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't tape record it, but I would have, and I would have played it back for everybody.
Okay.
You said before the show, yeah, but things, you know, the election did go pretty well in Vermont.
Yeah.
Which it did, and naturally it was going to, even though it was pretty close in the gubernatorial piece.
Right.
And so, I don't know, I just kind of feel like there's this Vermont aspect where I just feel it's so unrealistic here, and I think that's great, and it's a warm blanket that keeps me cozy at night.
Mm-hmm.
But I also sometimes feel like it's irresponsible.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily irresponsible.
I do.
Here's why.
Okay.
Here's why. Okay. Well, for one, I don't work in Vermont. I work in New Hampshire, where there's a lot more work to do. So
okay.
It's a place where things got mixed in those elections.
They did.
And I am concerned. I'm concerned. I mean, the governorship went fine, although there's still concerns. I mean, there wasn't a really ideal option. I'm not sure I'm 100% pleased with what the options were, but right. I'm glad that John Lynch is going to continue. But Senate races, House, things are a little, Keene, where I work, was not so bad, but mm-hmm. other places are worrisome. So in the work that I do, I need to step it up, because I get to go home to where I don't have to worry. So I have more energy
right.
to go into my work to go, okay, we got to worry over here. I'm fine when I get home. I'm going to put my effort into that. And I would say that we having it so nice here, it's irresponsible if we don't help out other places in some way.
I think most of us aren't. And I've talked about this. It's great. Vermont is great. It's great. Mm-hmm. Everyone should live in Vermont. But I then think that places a burden on Vermont that we are not embracing or acting on. And you are. I'm not. Well, no, I am.
No, you are. You get out there.
I get out there.
You're on the show.
I'm going to Connecticut this weekend. I'm talking to the youth. But I think that it places this burden on us. Great. We are so far along, as if it's a continuum. We'll just go with it. We are so far along. That means not complacency and disdain of all the other places that
right.
aren't so far along.
Right.
But that we have to step it up and be a leader for other people. And I don't think that Vermont... I don't know. I just feel like Vermont, if it was a person, is very content to be that. Although I will say this. I'm very happy about the Vermont election, and you can gauge for me the ethical dilemma that I'm facing, although I've already decided, in that with Peter Shumlin elected governor of Vermont, can I now go back and say when I pitched guests, hey, will you be on this radio show? I have a list of people we've had on, some notable ones. And it currently says state senator Peter Shumlin. Can I now say Vermont governor Peter Shumlin was on this show, So Gay?
Well, he wasn't the governor at the time.
Yeah, I don't agree. I don't agree. I think you're wrong. And I'm going to play music because I feel you're wrong. And I have decided differently than you have decided.
Okay.
Okay. This is a song by one of our past guests, Brian Kent. This came up on my iPod at the gym this morning, and I wanted to play for everybody. This is called I'll Find a Way, and we will. I put that on a mix for my dad. Loves it.
Cool.
Loves it. He's got my dad's. It's good having a gay son. I have to say, it's really good having a gay son. When I was home a few weeks ago, I'm not saying that straight people can't do this, but they can't. I made two mixes, one for my mom and one for my dad. And so my mom got just this amazing Broadway mix, and my dad got this beat pumping, very gay, but it gets my dad through the treadmill mix.
Okay.
There are benefits to a gay son. Just saying.
Hey.
Sure. Lesbians are great too, Jody. Don't give me that look.
Hey, you know, and actually, my dad's the one who wants to make me mix CDs of all sorts of blues collections that he has.
Oh.
He's quite the authority, actually. Self-taught completely.
Wow.
On blues and rare blues, and he gets a lot of compliments on his compilations.
Your dad's a pistol.
He sure is. That's a good word for him.
So as we know, it always goes really well when I try bells and whistles. So this is, I want to play a little bit from Anderson Cooper. Good old Andy.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I call him. I call him all the time. Mm. Interviewing Clint McCants.
Oh, yeah.
My buddy Clint, who we talked about last week. And so this interview happened after last week's show. I had the 100th The Show Was So Gay last week.
I know. I heard
it. Pretty cool. We talked a lot about
Clint
McCants. I don't know why I'm saying we, because it was just me. So this is Anderson Cooper interviewing Clint McCants.
So, Clint, you've written some really terrible things. You called gay kids who killed themselves because of bullying fags and queers. You wrote that you like to see gay people die. Do you really hate gay people that much that you like to see them die?
Anderson, I made some very ignorant comments. Did not realize just how ignorant they were. I've went back and looked over at the... I would never support suicide of any kids. I don't support bullying of any kids. I posted that on down further in my post that I hated it, you know, for those kids that they felt so hopeless.
But you sound,
that was the only place they had to turn.
But as you know, I mean, in the writing, you sound like a bully yourself. I mean, calling kids fags and queers, those are the words of a bully.
I was... like I said, I used some really strong language that, you know, and it wasn't correct, and it was too emotional. I've got two children myself, and I love them dearly. I've got a wife I love dearly. I don't agree with bullying in any shape, form, or fashion. I don't agree with it for any children. And, you know, the words I used were unfortunate, and they're, you know, I should have picked different ones, but it can't be taken back. And all I can do now is extend my apologies for my poor speech.
Some poor speech.
Uh-huh.
Jody, would you like to reflect on that very heartfelt apology?
Somebody gave him a talking to and smacked him around and said, you cannot say that. You must say better things. Use better words.
Use your
better words. So it seems like every time I'm on,
I know.
Every time I'm on, somebody, some other ignoramus has said something totally asinine and horrible and is about to or has just made one of these kinds of apologies, or we predict that they're going to make one of these sorts of apologies. It's
well, let me tell you this, let me correct you, because
it's
not every time you're on, it's at this point every week.
I
have a good example every week,
and
this was again, so Jody and I have talked about this before. What apology? I mean, what's the point? What is the point of him? How did that help at all? Anyone at all?
It doesn't. It doesn't help. It doesn't, because he said the stuff. He did say, I said it and I can't take it back. That's right. You did say it. Why did you say it in the first place? Why did you say it in such a public forum as a public figure? I mean, there's now this string of public figures who are, regardless of what they say, well, I wasn't saying it in my official capacity. I was saying it as a private citizen. Baloney. I'm sorry. You are a role model at all times, regardless of whether you're on the clock or not, because people are looking at you and they know who you are. They know who you are. In your community, they know who you are. The kids know who you are. Mm-hmm. And when you say stuff like that, it represents who you are in your public capacity as well as your private capacity. So you should not say stuff like that. It is not okay.
But once you do.
Once you do.
People will.
Once you do, then I think you need to visit with kids who have been bullied.
You don't get to go on Anderson Cooper and say, I used harsh words. My words were too emotional. I should have picked other words, like I hate gay people and hope they die. I'm kind of annoyed with Anderson Cooper because I really don't think that he should have had a forum for this. And I think Anderson Cooper knew what was coming and was really, I mean, Anderson was really aggressive. And then Dr. Phil was on Anderson Cooper, and Dr. Phil was saying, this was not an apology.
Okay.
We knew it wasn't going to be an apology.
Right.
I think the only thing this guy should have done was released one press statement and said, there is nothing I can say. I really don't. At this time, there is nothing I can say.
I think that's appropriate because I think it's right. Because what he just said was really nothing. He didn't say anything.
Gas bag. It's just a waste of airtime.
It is a waste of airtime.
And Anderson Cooper was trying to get him to say more. And I'm sitting there thinking, okay, great. So you're really grilling him. But then I was thinking, what are you even trying to get from him? What is it, Anderson Cooper, that you think that you can get this guy to say that is going to be satisfying short of, I am a horrible person? Actually, no, that's it. I'm a horrible person. I mean, I don't understand what the point even was, except to say, you're not sorry. Great. But of course, there was no way he could be sorry 24 hours later. There's no way.
Right. No.
That is not possible.
Not unless he had some sort of epiphany, which he went into great detail.
Maybe that's more my point. He couldn't.
No.
He could not have had an epiphany about it.
Well, he obviously didn't. And I don't know if Anderson was hoping that maybe he was trying to be idealistic. And maybe because I'm grilling him so hard, maybe I'll actually make him have an epiphany. Or it's a hot story.
I mean, I just felt like it was.
Yes. I want to make him cry because. Yeah. As you are well aware, I don't watch TV very much.
Me neither.
Right. and part of it is because a lot of it I find either mildly irritating or really upsetting. And also the whole thing is very expensive. However, I don't know, Anderson Cooper very well in his style. So I don't know if he would be just ratings grabbing or if he was really trying to like, have some sort of social justice point of view with this.
Well, he's on a kick.
Uh-huh.
Anderson Cooper is definitely on this kick because he really got all the press for the brouhaha about, did you see this, the Ron Howard movie that's coming out with Vince Vaughn, where Vince Vaughn says in the preview, the coming attractions clip, something, his character says, oh, this is gay. And I don't mean gay, I mean gay. It's like my whole freaking show here. And so
it's like your thesis.
Well, it's my whole dissertation.
Yeah,
And Anderson Cooper saw the preview and he really got a lot of press for saying this was unacceptable.
Okay.
And that story, we haven't really covered that story much on the show. That story continues to go on and grab headlines.
Huh.
Ron Howard said they're not taking the quote out, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, so Anderson Cooper is definitely on this kick.
Okay.
And so he's definitely covering LGBT story after LGBT story. He was on Ellen talking about bullying. And that's actually where he mentioned the Ron Howard movie. Anyway.
Right, right.
So I don't know. He's on CNN. So I don't think I could possibly sit here and say he's not ratings grabbing. That's a part of being on TV. But he's definitely, I don't know. I think he's speaking his mind more than.
Which is great.
It's great. It's great.
Yeah.
It's so tough. It's so tough to wrap your mind, because I'm of two minds about Anderson Cooper, because you have all the stories of people trying to out him, and he's gay, but he's not coming out. And that kind of annoys me, because it doesn't. First of all, I don't think you have to be gay to wield your voice and create change for all different types of communities. But then at the same time, I don't know. I kind of would be interested if he is gay and him coming out, because I think that he reaches a whole different segment of the population. But I don't know. Mm. So then there's this whole, there's always this subtext to Anderson Cooper covering these stories. But mm-hmm. this one, I just felt like, yes, it was big ratings. This was a big story. That Facebook group had, I think that Facebook group at this point has a couple hundred thousand people in it for him to fire him, even though you can't fire him and he's retiring.
Right.
But I just didn't get the point. I didn't get what would have been satisfying. And it went on. That thing went on for like 12, 13 minutes.
So, oh, wow.
Anyway, I am going to play a song that I would like to dedicate to Jenny Karstad and also to Jody Clark, but mostly to Jenny Karstad, because I think that she's really going to like this one, because when I hear this song, I think about her.
Okay.
Okay. Enjoy.
Same apartment since 1943. They've got embroidered pictures on the wall with quotes that no one said, and an autographed picture of Jesus Christ above their double bed. Well, they're two old ladies, that can't be denied. But their matching aprons hide a wilder side. And they will tell you about Paris over countless cups of tea. And maybe you will get the clue, but at first it eluded me that they're the founding mothers of the revolution, of mating with a blatant disregard for evolution. Lesbians extraordinaire, years before they cut their hair. Four stories over all the pushing and the shoving. Hattie and Maddie got some brownies in the oven, sitting and knitting and loving their whole life through. Hattie and Maddie met through Gertrude Stein one summer day at a déjeuner divine. Hattie said, I'm fond of La Joconde and her strange and sexy style. So Maddie said, well, Leonardo's dead, but I know what made her smile. Now Hattie and Maddie bake for the neighborhood. 4 years they've been spreading love in any way they could. 'Cause it's a special recipe that they got from Alice B. So I should have known when I heard the groans, but it took me years to see that they're the founding mothers of the revolution, of mating with a blatant disregard for evolution. Lesbians extraordinaire, years before they cut their hair. Four stories over all the pushing and the shoving. Hattie and Maddie got some brownies in the oven, sitting and knitting and loving their whole life through. Disregard for evolution. Lesbians extraordinaire, years before they cut their hair. Four stories over all the pushing and the shoving. Hattie and Maddie got some brownies in the oven, sitting and knitting and loving their whole life through. Yes, they're the founding mothers of the revolution.
You love it.
It's really cute.
You love it.
It's very, very cute.
I knew that you would like that one. Tell me that's not your new theme song.
Well, we'll see.
I'm going to start calling you Hattie. Just accept it. We're going to move on. All right. Should we welcome a guest?
Yes.
Guest, are you there and what ready to be welcomed?
I am ready and waiting to be welcomed.
That's a good thing. Let me introduce you. Chad Gohler Sojourner is an award-winning Seattle-based solo performer. In July of 2008, his highly anticipated solo show, entitled Sitting in Circles with Rich White Girls, Memoirs of a Bulimic Black Boy, debuted at Seattle's Brown Box African American Theater, receiving overwhelming support and accolades from the community at large and tons of different organizations. He created the chapbook entitled Born 1,000 Years Too Early, Fat, Dark-Skinned, Gay, and Adopted by White Folks, A Fragmentary Journey Towards Alignment. And he has served as creator and artistic director of People of Color Against AIDS Network's production entitled Standing in the Gap and Speaking Their Names, Black Gay Poets Honor Their Ancestors, A Spoken Word Requiem. Chad Gohler Sojourner, welcome to this show, Is So Gay.
Well, thank you. It is so wonderful to be welcomed, and I'm so excited you all found me and we have connected.
We love finding new people. Then, Chad, the question that's on everybody's mind, do you get yourself involved in any projects that have titles of maybe three words?
Well, see, I'm the title queen. See, I title the project. you know, so if there's already a title attached to it, I can't do it. I am the title queen.
Yeah, I'm thinking, is the title going to end? No, that's a colon. There's more after the colon.
That's what we writers do, you know? I just thought sometimes we just have a bucket of, like, colons and semicolons and things, and we just throw them up in there.
I love it. I love it. Now, happy post-election day.
Yes.
Any reflections on the election?
You know, oh, goodness. Well, you know, sometimes I have a vault that I keep in my mind called the I Told You So, where I tell people things and sometimes they don't listen. And one of the things, you know, this whole Tea Party, briefly, years and years ago, I said, you know, these people are going to storm the gates one day because those are the people that often were kind of the poor white people who were called white trash and who were kind of had been discarded by the middle class whites and upper class whites. And I said, one day they'll come storming the gates, and I think they have. Now, the fact that they are now on the other side, it kind of diminishes their power and their anger. So, but I am concerned. I'm concerned that, you know, some of these people, we've gone back where you could just be come out of the woodwork and haven't even been on the PTA, but you're qualified to be a senator.
Right. Right. Well, hey.
You've been to the PTA first.
Well, I have to tell you how you came about being on the show. I have a friend of mine out west who saw you perform in a show, and she wrote to me and said, you need to get Chad on your show. And I said, oh, okay. But, you know, what's his style? What's his angle? And she said, and I quote, because this is from an email, she said, I quote, this is a performer with a definitive voice. Ask him about his voice. So, Chad, I ask you, how would you go about describing your voice to our listening audience?
Well, I am a storyteller. I've been telling stories longer than I can remember. I started telling them as a survival mechanism. I was fat and black and 50 in the 70s. My parents are white. And so every time I showed up into a room, there was a hostile element. So I also had to kind of, you know, be the entertainer and many kind of watching. So I started collecting a lot of stories, too, because I was in a lot of rooms with different people, too. So I would say that, you know, I would tell stories to myself sometimes because I was kind of a lonely childhood at times too. And I would just kind of continue to tell them. And in my mind, they make sense. It's kind of things about my life. You know, my parents are from Montana. So, you know, back in the 70s and probably 80s, you know, when you go on family trips, you get in the car and go to where your grandparents live, basically.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of black kids went down south or went someplace. I'd never been any place to Montana or Wyoming.
Hmm.
So all my childhood stories involve Wyoming and Montana, which sounds odd, but to me it made perfect sense. And so when I tell stories about, you know, going to Great Falls, Montana in the 70s with my brother and going to the Paris Gibson Pool and jumping in and all the white kids jumping out. And
oh my.
I'm the younger of the two. I thought, oh, is it like, you know, like a, not a fire drill, but you're at the pool and they blow the whistle?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
They were jumping out. I didn't know that they were jumping out because I was black.
Oh.
You know, so that becomes, you know, a story, you know, part of, you know, that I tell and retell, and that manifests itself in different places. With this show in particular, the story is because I was wanting to be a rich white girl. That's what I thought I was born to be. And the closest I came was to getting this white girl's eating disorder, basically.
Right.
And so well, this story is kind of interesting and unique is that I was one of the first boys in the country diagnosed with the disease after 4 years of doing it.
Right.
I probably got caught in, like, 86. And, the scampering, trying to find treatment, and what does treatment look like, because there's not even a treatment modality. You ask me about something, like, oh, that's part of the story. So I don't have a set of stories, but I would say they do tie, basically, to my identity, which also kind of makes sense to me, but sometimes to other people.
Well, and you mentioned identity, and I want to talk about identity a little bit, and I'm going to read a quote from your website, which I loved. You have on your website, quote, "My work explores the often complex and misunderstood world of identity construction and self-preserving mechanisms, specifically how growing up fat, black, gay, bulimic, and raised by white parents affected and shaped both my development and recovery from an eating disorder." And we talk a lot about identity development on this show. How do you what's your take on identity development, how that process happens?
Yeah, so I think it's changed. I think for people who, today with the internet and life is very different, but for older people, at least for my case, a lot of stuff happened simultaneously. So I come from kind of the school of thought that all these things were happening at the same time. I didn't really come out, and if you saw me walking down the street, if I opened my mouth, you knew I was, you would assume I was gay.
Right.
So I come from that sissy, from the old school sissy, which had its own set of blessings and problems. So I didn't have that sort of identity. At the same time, although I look black and I'm very dark, I was, I went to a white church, I had white neighbors, I had, my friends, so I was kind of, I watched white TV. There wasn't a lot of black TV on the 70s. So I had to form all these different identities that have kind of, like I said, sometimes they've meshed. And
right.
Sometimes, often people talk about this kind of crossroads with this four-way stop. For me, and for a lot of people like me, it's not even the way it kind of happens. Sometimes it's the overpass. So, for instance, weight. So, being fat and weight, and even if I haven't been fat, is much a part of my identity space and the space I take up. I could, regardless of what I weigh, I can look at a chair and tell you how much that chair could hold. Or could I get in that booth now or at a different place?
Right.
Well, it happens to, a fair amount of, when I begin to do and I talk and do workshops and talk with, especially about trans men who fully embodied, pass as male, look as male, are male, fully male, but at some point they were socialized, even probably under will, as a young girl. And so some things about, voice that is when it's a kind of an interesting conversation because I don't believe you can just like shut off, like friends who were born, you were like, they call themselves ex-Catholics or ex-Mormons. Like, look, if you came from a fundamentalist church already, you can walk away, you can become right with that, but part of that's you, because that's part of that, the ritual, the family, all that stuff is part of you. And so I think for my identity, I had to learn to be black. I know that sounds kind of odd, but I really did. I mean, when I went to, like a lot of adopted kids, I went away to college and became more immersed in what it meant to be an African American.
Right.
And the host, what did that look like? And had to learn to, had to fall in love with being black, which was an interesting process.
Yeah.
Learn to love what was staring back at me, not just from the weight side, but from the race side. And those are two different things. So I had, weight issues, but then I also had, wait a second, why do nobody in your fantasies or in your life look like you? Why do you find anybody attractive? So you want to be thin, but you're not looking at, Wesley Snipes
The other thing that we've definitely noticed in your writing is that there's definitely a thread about bullying And with all of the recent coverage of the very high-profile suicides and bullying cases, what actions do you hope that communities are going to be taking to combat this epidemic of bullying?
Well, at first, I think we need to just sit for a spell and we need to look and say, first of all, hasn't all of been this like this? I was talking to some people, I'm part of a poetic thing that's happened here in a couple of weeks, about, I remember, you know, in New York in the early 90s, when stuff was, this was happening, and I was working with ACT UP and Lesbian Avengers and Coronation, like, we showed up, you know. We didn't sign online petitions, we didn't wear purple. We actually showed up to school board meetings, just like the conservative Christians were doing. We showed up to superintendents' homes if we needed to, and it stopped. You know, we were able to dress. You know, a lot of my bullying had to do with racial stuff, but my mom showed up. You know, and that's, sometimes you have to show up and get a little crazy. You know, my mom showed up and walked in there and said, "You know, I'm going to the papers."
Right.
My
right.
White mom, you know, who was a crazy writer, and she showed up and didn't stop it forever. Of course not. But sometimes you have to actually show up for these kids, and you also, we have to look at and say that this is not acceptable. You know, school is an interesting place.
Mm-hmm.
Years ago, before this, I kind of had this thought, like, school's kind of like jury duty in jail. You don't have the choice. You have to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're compelled to be there, because if you don't show up in some schools, they will send the police or church or your parents or you'll be in trouble.
Right.
So if you're going to make me come here, you need to protect these kids. Right now, we are telling people to send their kids here. They have no choice. It's the law. But they're not protecting them. So there's some complicity amongst the schools, the kids. I mean, it's just the whole hand. And, you know, I understand that it gets better, and I believe it gets better. I believe we make it better. But, you know, that's not an excuse for, you know, we're not a shy people. I mean, I know some queer folks who have and can get stuff done real quickly.
Right.
And, you know, so I think we need to be more aggressive in what we do and how we address these kids. Because I think that it takes three things for bullying. You need a bully, easy to find, victim, easy to find, but you also need a receptive and complicit body, like 30 kids in the class. You know, I firmly believe that if you could just change 5 or 10 of those kids, just say, hey, not cool, before the kid dies. After the kid dies, everyone's on vigil, they all have something to say. But in the moment, what would it look like if you started texting that? Or, you know, you have these camera phones in school. I mean, when I was in, it was your word against somebody else's. Now you can actually prove. What would that be like? Bully the bullies. You know. So I think more needs to get done. And I think parents or guardians or whoever just need to do whatever it takes. I also understand that with these kids, one of the things, you know, that really hurts my heart with these young men is we're kind of missing out, you know, not even so much about whether they're gay. I mean, they're 13. You know, they're being perceived. These are the 50s. I mean, I would be one of these kids today. And I think one of the wrong assumptions people make is because your body moves that way, which kind of has a fluidity, and for me it's more natural than water. But my body moved that way and told on myself long before I knew when I was comfortable with myself. So I think sometimes we give these kids, you know, these young kids who are bullied. So some of these kids might not even want to be gay. They might not be, that might be the worst thing in their mind, but yet their body is kind of betraying them, which is kind of, I talk about in a different way in the show.
Yeah.
So our bodies often betray us. So it's not a good thing. I don't like it, and I don't know if I'm really liking the way it's heading on. I don't know if I'm right now. I don't know if the response is, if I like the response that much.
Yeah. Well, I was checking out some of your past performances and the different places that you've done your show. And what was really interesting to me as a student affairs person, and I know Chad, you're a student affairs person as well.
FBI.
it's our backbone. It's who we are. What was really interesting were the different. I, of course, with my student affairs eye, I'm always looking. Well, who sponsored it? And there's a real range of different offices on college campuses that have sponsored you, which, for people who don't work at Student Affairs, don't know, that's actually kind of odd. So to have one performance sponsored at one school by an Office of Multicultural Affairs and at another school by an Office of Health Education and at another school by Student Activities, you don't actually normally see that. And so I was thinking, okay, they either don't know what to do with you, which I don't think it is what it is, or you just, what you're saying just cuts across so many different areas. Like, what types of audiences do you envision having for performances?
Well, one thing, so I started in performance poetry, and I worked with other, and I started doing queer stuff, and then I came over and did some black queer stuff, and then performed before black straight audiences, and when I had my own show, everybody just came, and I realized that, you know, that I have my own, you know, because it does really cut across band. I mean, there'll be rich white girls from, you know, your women who are there, and, you know, there'll be a lot of kids who are transracially adopted, or parents who with, you know, kids of a different race.
Mm-hmm.
On the school part of that, I always say that I market myself better than other people, because one of the things is that people kind of put blinders on, so, like, we... Even like, oh well, they wouldn't do that, or that wouldn't work here, or, and I think like, well, yeah, this story is as much about being adopted as it is about an eating disorder. It's as much about being a sissy as it is about, you know, weight and scale and all that, you know, from the health standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the audience, if you open it up and invite people early and often. If it was something meaningful, they will come. And here in Seattle, you know, I think we have so many great things that are always going on. You know, you kind of do. You have to market it to the widest stance. I think at schools, when I work with schools, universities, I often contact different groups and kind of do a connection. Like, oh, you know, like when I was at Dartmouth, there was health, but they also had the, you know, sororities, fraternities, because they have a huge, like 7% of people or 60% are in sororities.
Right.
What else? Sorority, excuse me. And, you know, so that's, you know, that's a unique thing. And it's great because sometimes these people haven't been in the same room. They might be in the same school or building, but they have not been in the same room. It's always interesting. Certain people laugh more at certain things and, you know, certain people get things. Like, I think it's always accessible, but it's always nice to have. Because very few of us are just that one thing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, and issues overlap anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
What kind of responses do you get from your audience? Is it always what you intend or anticipate, or do you get surprised frequently?
You know, so my intention is that they take away, you know, what they've come for. So if it's entertainment, it's here. You know, so there's various things. I would say that, you know, my black audience tend to be just generally a little more vocal. You know, when I travel, I have to, like, you know, I encourage. I mean, there's some, you know, as a solo performer and somebody who's works with other solo performers, and, you know, there's some heavy stuff. I mean, I'm okay. I'm telling the story, but you need to know that I'm okay. Because there's a lot of humor, and so you have to let people know, like, when it's, how to, you know, that they can laugh. I think the takeaway, we used to have these what are called talk backs where people ask questions and I kind of tell them more about the story. But one of the things I like for people to do is to kind of, you know, although it's set in, this, you know, in a certain time frame in the beginning, it really is kind of like fluid. We all have these places, you know, we all have these things we're asked, put in this box, we don't fit totally in there, or we want to be in this other box, or for instance, self-preserving mechanisms, which is a unifying firm theme. If you got one, you know, I start by telling you, you know, one of the things that nobody ever tells you about them is that their purpose is to protect the current self, your right then and there self, which in my case was the child self. That begins to unify a lot of people, because you know, whether it be food, gambling, sex, whatever, everything. We've all, you know, many of us have had these things that have served us well. but we don't know how to let go to them, how to let them go.
Right.
So I think that's kind of a takeaway that people get, regardless of, you know, how they entered the venue.
And do you have performances coming up that we should all know about?
Well, so I'm going back on tour, so if anybody, you know, they can sign me through the website, which is sitting-incircles.com, or you can Google me or Facebook and all of those stuff. And so I tour, I'm still doing touring colleges. I have a performance here in Seattle on November 19th and 20th. Again, I'm excited about that. And then I'm going to go back. There's a written memoir version of this that I have begun, and I would like to kind of continue that and move on. I have some other solo shows in my mind that I've been working on and kind of jotting down, and I'd like to kind of continue. But, you know, I think this is a great story. I think it's it's a great story for other people, too. And I was thinking, I'd love to see somebody. I think it's going to make a great full play. Could be a great musical. So if you're anybody out there who wants to turn it into a musical, Hitting Circles with Rich White Girls, Memoirs of the Bulimic Black Boy.
I'm so nervous.
I have been using it, but I see it in my mind. I see it, and I saw this in my mind before it came to fruition. So.
When you say the title of your work, I just get nervous that some newspaper is going to call you and say, Chad, we want you to write a piece for us, and it can't be more than 500 words, and then you finish writing the title, and you realize you only have 3 words left.
It really is. That's the full title, but often, when I'm posting it on something, you get, City in Circles. I write a million times, so I prefer not to say the whole. Absolutely, in Seattle, I can just say City in Circles, or City, or Chad's Play.
I just love that. I love that. I love the idea of you writing out the title and then looking down at the page and thinking, "Ah, crap! I just hit my word count." I just think that's fantastic.
It happens. When I go back to rework it, I'm like, okay, I count the words in the whole book. Basically, say, okay, look, you can't have any more. So if you want to add a word, you have to take another round. Because there's so much, and when crafting a show, the show's pretty tight and. And it's really, it's important to be that way because I'm introducing people to stuff.
Well, the website that everybody must go to is sitting-in-circles.com. Chad, if this show is about nothing, it is about people using their voice. And I love having you on the show because you are a man using his voice. You have a story to tell. You're not staying quiet about it. You're creating conversation. You're creating dialogue through the simple act of saying, look, this is my story. I want to hear yours as well. And so we love it, Chad. You're going to keep on using your voice, correct?
I am, and thank you. I do come, and check out the website, and I will be in touch with you all and keep it, I think it's such a great service. I think this is one of the great things about the web, is that, you can have that voice and hook up with this voice and take it to, some other place.
Absolutely.
So I think that is a great use of the web. And I think we need to be all witnesses.
Right.
If you take nothing away and if you actually have listened to me, ramble for the left, whatever. Remember that you're responsible to leave your own mark to be your witness. I realize that I have no children. I don't plan on having children. And a couple years ago, I said, when I go, I want my story left behind. So do something to let people know that you were here. It doesn't have to be a solo show. Go back to your junior high and tag. I was
there. It is.
Fat kids and cut down the rope or whatever, but let somebody know that you were here.
There it is. That's what it is.
Okay.
Chad, an absolute pleasure having you on the show. You keep doing what you're doing, and we hope to talk to you more in the future.
You can call me. Thanks, guys.
All the best, Chad.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
And that actually brings us to the end of tonight's show, number 101. I'm not going to count every show. I just wanted to put out there 101 because it's easier to remember.
Okay.
That was Chad Goler, Sojourner, sitting-in-circles.com. Go and check it out. Book Chad for a school, any type of organization near you, because he has got a story to tell. Just a very, very quick update, and then we got to get the heck out of here, is over in Uganda. I'm always about giving the Uganda update.
Oh, yeah.
Uganda's high court has ordered a controversial newspaper to stop publishing the names and photographs of people it says are gay, ruling that the publication is violating their right to privacy. And that just happened 2 days ago because there was this paper when Carrie was guest hosting a few weeks ago. We were just talking about how this paper started publishing the names and addresses of people who were gay on the front page. And then, shockingly, these people were experiencing some harassment. So good job, Uganda's High Court. We got to get the heck out of here.
We do.
You folks, go out there. Go do some amazing things. Use your voice. And above all else, remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?